Basically, what I'd like to ask you to do is, as all the readings I've had on how to do a personal interview, is kind of start with your own background, you know, where you took your undergraduate degree, and lead into how you came to Michigan State and came to your position as provost, and take it from there.
I earned my baccalaureate degree at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
I was a major in psychology there. Then I was in World War II. And at the end of World War II, with the GI Bill, I was able to contemplate going anywhere that I could be admitted. So I ended up in the Department of Psychology at Stanford, which is where I earned my master's degree, my PhD degree.
Mm-hmm.
My major was psychology with a concentration in clinical psychology. My minor was something that there was called human physiology. So that was my PhD work.
When did you get your PhD work?
1949. Mm-hmm. Got my MA in 1946. Entered graduate school in 1945, August, mm-hmm. September 1949. At the time that I received my PhD at Stanford, my major professor left there to become the chairperson of the Department of Psychology at the University of Chicago, so there was a vacancy. And I was hired on the faculty at Stanford immediately on getting my PhD. I was the director of the psychological clinic there, and I left there in 1961 to come to Michigan State. The reason that I left Stanford was that the university had made a policy decision that it was going to focus on theory and basic research. And as a clinical psychologist, I had my choice either to shift to something that was considered a more basic field, such as child development or personality or some such thing, or move to an institution that had a viable clinical psychology program, because it was clear that Stanford University was going to discontinue its clinical psychology program. So I came to Michigan State. I came here as professor and director of the psychological clinic. I left after 1 year because the chairperson of the department became a dean, and I had the alternative of going to the University of Southern California at that point as the senior person in the clinical psychology program there, which I did. Then, during the year that I was at USC, Michigan State approached me and asked me to come here again as chairperson of the Department of Psychology. I decided to do that. I was chairperson from 1964 to 1967. I was dean of the College of Social Science from 1967 to 1974. I became associate provost in 1974 here, and then was appointed provost in 1977. I served in that capacity until I reached age 65. And by the policy of the university, one leaves an administrative assignment here on July 1, following the year in which you become 65.
Oh, that's why July 1 for Dr. Cantlin.
So, well, actually, John Cantlin's been held over. Past now 4 years, I've been serving as a professor in psychology. That's sort of the story of my academic life.
That sounds very fascinating. You've had a good, well-rounded exposure to a lot of schools and a lot of different disciplines. I envy you. It really sounds great to me.
I've had a very satisfying career.
When you came in as assistant provost, was that your first exposure administratively to the University College?
No. I was exposed to the University College immediately on coming here, but more to the point, when I became chairperson of the Department of Psychology in 1964, one of the questions that was being discussed by a few members of the psychology department was whether there was any way in which we would want to relate to the general education program. We didn't get very excited about it because, as a matter of fact, about 95% of the freshmen who enrolled at Michigan State University enrolled at that time at Michigan State University enrolled in the beginning psychology course. So de facto, we were part of the liberal studies program of almost every undergraduate student here. So
I took it, I remember taking
it. So we said, well, you know, there's general education, but in effect, we're as much a part of liberal studies as general education is because of the enrollment patterns. So nothing came of that, really. Then when I became dean of the College of Social Science, I approached the then dean of University College, who was Ed Carlin at that time, and suggested to him that it would be worth considering some kind of joint enterprise where the Department of Social Science and University College faculty members could participate in departments in the College of Social Science, and where faculty in the departments in the College of Social Science in turn could participate in the general education program offered by, that part of it offered by the Department of Social Science. One of the stipulations that I made was that if we tried to work out such a joint enterprise, one of the things that I wanted to be available to our graduate students when they reached an advanced point, and those who had a genuine interest, would have the opportunity to do some teaching in the general education program, because I thought that would be both a liberalizing experience for our graduate students who are going to go into college and university teaching, but also I thought that they would be able to bring something in the way of additional perspective, since psychology was not an explicit part of the Department of Social Science courses. Well, to make that as short as possible, the people, the dean and the chairperson of the Department of Social Science, decided they weren't interested.
Because of their policy, they were always having full professors teaching. Did anyone set a precedent? Is that what it was?
Well, I'm sure that was part of it. I don't know what all the reasons were. I didn't press for them to have to declare anything very much. I didn't think that would be very fair. I had made a sort of low-key
gesture
approach to them, and we had some talks, and so I didn't want to make a big thing out of it. When they said they weren't interested in going further, I said, you know, I was very sorry to hear that. I thought that it was an unfortunate decision on their part. If they ever wanted to reconsider while I was dean of college, they ought to get in touch with me, because I would continue to be open to discussion. Well, so that was probably around 1965, 1966. I can't give you for sure dates on that, but it's fairly early in the time that I was serving as dean. Then, along about 1967, 1968, and again, I left all of my administrative type documents in the provost's office when I became a regular rank and file faculty member, as Walter Adams said.
As you've seen, Dr. Adams, just a few minutes ago, he brought up the thing.
When I became a rank and file faculty member, I decided I'd leave the administrative paraphernalia for the next provost. So I don't have a copy of the report of the so-called Committee on Undergraduate Education. But that was in the late 60s. And I think it was probably 1967, but maybe in 1968 or 69. That was a major study. I hope you're acquainted with it. If you aren't, you should become acquainted with it. That committee, which was a faculty-wide committee, recommended that there should be options within the general education program. Parallel to that committee, the faculty of University College itself was recommending options. So the point of that is that toward the end of the 1960s here, both as a general faculty recommendation and also as a recommendation emerging from University College itself, there was the decision that there would be a wider array of course offerings under the general education label.
Is that what they would call their tracking system?
Yes. There was more than that. There were options within tracks. So it was it just progressively became more and more dispersed.
It almost sounds like they became more like the rest of the universities that were in the program.
Well, in my judgment, de facto, what they did was go. They went to distributed liberal education concept,
mm-hmm.
and really departed from the original integrative studies model of general education, mm-hmm. which had been the hallmark of University College for most of its existence, including the time that it was called Basic College.
Several of the professors and chairmen that were from outside of the University College that I've interviewed, because I wanted to get not just people within the University yeah. College and administrators, but also, you might say, like third-party people, have said to me that the final demise of the University College at Michigan State started with that approach.
Yes.
When they started doing that, it became a threat to the other departments.
Well, and it not only became a threat, I think the threat part of it was the least important part. If you look at the intellectual justification of having a university college, the intellectual justification is that it was going to do something that wasn't going to be done by the standard departments.
So they'd lost their mission.
So they in essence abdicated their mission.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did that, in my judgment, there was no longer any justification for paying the overhead costs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the other thing they did that was very much against the interest of the larger university was to sustain, in a very doctrinaire way, this thing of every general education course that carried a university college number would be taught by a full-time faculty member. Now, the mystique about that is that that meant that all those courses were taught by people with a PhD or equivalent degree. The fact was that many of the University College faculty members who were hired during the 1960s were ABDs. So they had full-time faculty members teaching general education who had not completed the qualifying degree that their doctrine called for. Now that's intellectual dishonesty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what really undermined their position.
I've heard, that one of the first thing I heard from the outside was how they went to these tracks and how they, in essence, started to identify this as my program, this is your program. You know, the kind of things you hear from people in other departments. From within the department itself, I've heard that cropped. It came in the late 60s of professors. One labeled them the Young Turks, agitated and caused some real problems.
And several of those people didn't have qualifying degrees.
Yeah.
See, now, let's go back to what I proposed when I was dean. So what I was proposing when I was dean was that we have advanced graduate students who are ready to do their dissertation become teaching fellows within the general education program, and that's what was refused.
In essence, that's what they had.
But that's what they had, de facto, in a significant percentage of their full-time faculty members.
Do you think that, we're guessing here, but do you think possibly because they would have been sharing them with their department rather than having unique control of them, that might have caused them their concern? I'm just guessing at this point.
I think that they, let me tell you what I think the power issue was, which is, mm-hmm. I think, responsive. As long as a person has the title of faculty member, that is at least an instructor on a full-time basis, they're voting members of the faculty. And I think what the dean at that time was looking at was the number of votes that that college had. If you replace 25% of those regularly appointed faculty with teaching fellows, you'd have reduced your votes by 25%.
How much percent of the total faculty was in that department vote by?
Well, they were, at that time they had something over 200 faculty members appointed in the tenure system, and the tenure system at that time was approximately 2,300, so it was very close to 10%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you turned out almost all of your 200 faculty members, you could control a faculty senate meeting, mm-hmm. an academic senate meeting, on most issues, because generally speaking, you can pick up enough additional votes. So even if you have 400 or 500 faculty members in a senate meeting,
these corporations,
you can still vote it.
Yeah. People that only 10% are chairman of the board.
Now, I think that's what the issue was.
Hmm. That's interesting. One of the administrators that I talked to said also that in the early to mid-70s, there occurred briefly a small minority of faculty that wanted to unionize.
Correct.
And what did you feel as far as where these people were? Were they spread throughout the university, or were they part of the university college? Or where would you, if you were to say, if you located the epicenter of the movement, where would you have located it?
Actually, there were two movements toward unionization here. One was an AAUP movement, which was a sort of general sampling of the faculty from across the university. The other was something that came to be known as faculty associates, which was sponsored by the MEA, the Michigan Education Association. The faculty associate leadership was in University College. And one of the weaknesses, I don't think we would have had a faculty union in any case, but one of the weaknesses of the effort to unionize this faculty was that you had these competitors. And the faculty member who wasn't particularly attracted to unionization but was willing to listen would hear these competing union-oriented groups debating each other and say, you know, I don't need this additional foolishness.
I gathered that it was a very small minority group.
Well, the actual votes, there were two or three votes, I can't remember which. The votes were roughly 60%, 40%, 60% against unionization, 40% for unionization. But now again, remember, the people who are voting are the people who want a union primarily. It's always difficult. School millage elections.
You understand that?
Oh, yes.
No.
We have. I always say that you have 20% of your total population that is vehemently against.
Sure.
You have 20% that are for, but.
But in unionization, you have the flip side of that. Everybody who wants a union will vote.
Yeah. Well, the no votes will always vote.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. The yes votes will vote yes if the weather's good that day.
Right.
And then that leaves you the 60% who, in general, really don't give a damn.
Yeah.
And
right.
You've got to hit them somewhere where they live.
Yeah.
To get them to come.
That's right. Well, so, the fact that we had 60% voting against the union doesn't mean that only 60% of the faculty were opposed to the union. It simply means that's the nature of the vote. So my answer to your question is that yes, the university college faculty was represented. Again, we don't have any way of knowing what percent of university college faculty that was, but we know the leadership of faculty associates came primarily out of university college.
Mm-hmm. How about the student body? Did you feel that it had changed to the point that the university college model, as they were not doing it, was serving or not serving the student population?
Let me answer this way and see if it's responsive. For a significant proportion of people who enroll here as freshmen and have enrolled as freshmen over the years, I think there is a contribution to an integrated studies program, because the variation in the quality of liberal studies in secondary schools is such
that you'll always have 30% or 60% or 45% or something rather of your freshman class that have not had a good presentation of arts and letters, humanities, of natural sciences, of social sciences, or will have significant weaknesses in, say, two of the three. So I think there was a service mission, and there would still be a service mission, in fact, for an integrative studies program that was integrative. I may as well tell you now as later, I think that the concept of integrative studies is anti-intellectual. But you have to remember, I went to an excellent high school
I went to what was
the equivalent of a high-quality prep school. When I went to high school, we had a college preparatory program in high school, and I went to UCLA and I went to Stanford. So my idea of challenging education is probably different than a lot of people.
Unfortunately, our shared idea of education is a lot different. I've come to the conclusion philosophically that our country was founded by people who believed in education but had a populace that did not believe in education and were anti-education. And the reason I say this is if you look at those who came over here in the boats to escape the establishment in Europe, the establishment in Europe used education as one of the means of perpetuating themselves. And so these people, when they came over here, viewed education as one of the tools of the oppressors. And we're basically anti-education. And I think, unfortunately for us, that still permeates us. And if you want to see it really in its ugliest form, you have to be in an executive session of a school board that's locally hired, like I have been, or locally elected, and watch and listen to them as they instruct their superintendent to teach the kids. Yeah,
I think we're in agreement on a fundamental issue.
Mm-hmm.
In general, our society is anti-intellectual, and I think your historical comment is very relevant. I think where we may part company is, see, my feeling is that if you have an integrated studies program, what you're doing is substituting an intellectual aristocracy and their view for the opportunity that would be to challenge our students to acquire information and think on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a problem with the merits of an integrative study strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a very, very, I'm a member of a very small minority on that issue. I know that, let's leave that aside for the moment, because it is an aside. Come back to your question. Yes, I think that if we had the kind of general education program that we had here in, say, the mid-50s or early 60s, whenever that division from basic to university college was made.
Starting in 52.
That four area general education program was an integrative studies program, and I think that would still be a distinct service for some significant percentage of people who enter here as freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize that that's a distinct possibility.
So you're saying the model itself is a good concept, it's just that the times and the personalities of individuals is what kind of led to its destruction.
Yeah, you see, if you say that a responsibility of education in this country is to provide the citizens with a common core of knowledge and an acquaintance with a diversity of areas of knowledge, you can then move to the rationale for an integrative studies program. And if you take those two steps, then yes, the model was a very good model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now let's go back and pick up the history of University College.
We're early 70s now.
All right, now let's go to 1972 specifically.
Okay.
In 1972, the organization within our academic governance system that's known as the Academic Council, which is really the legislature,
mm-hmm.
It has faculty, students, administrators as members. Okay. 1972, the academic council, on behalf of the constituencies of this university, adopted a major policy position that has to do with general education. And the essence of it is that that 1972 decision said that departments, in addition to the university college departments, should offer general education courses. Not may, should. And particularly from the legislative history, the discussion, it was the College of Arts and Letters, the College of Natural Science, the College of Social Science, that this university was looking to add options to the general education cafeteria. And in fact, those three colleges did. So now we're in the 1970s, and what do we have? We have University College with three departments called Humanities, which is like College of Arts and Letters, Natural Science, which is like the College of Natural Science, Social Science, which is College of Social Science, who themselves had elected to diversify their course offerings and tracks. We had the Q report as background, which recommended that trajectory. We had the 1972 decision, which said not only university college departments, but other departments ought to be offering general education courses.
You can see it coming.
So, how does one make some sense, both in terms of efficiency and effectiveness, out of this thing?
Well, it sounds like you got two different groups competing for the same student. Yeah.
So what I did as provost was to recommend that the university college should be closed down as a college, that the four departments that were in university college should be assigned in totality to the three so-called core colleges. So the Department of American Thought and Language, which was offering the freshman composition writing program, and the Department of Humanities went to the College of Arts and Letters. The Department of Natural Science went to the College of Social Science. Natural Science. The Department of Social Science went to the College of Social Science. So now what I have, you have a reduction in overhead cost, and you have put the Department of American Thought and Language is really sort of a different issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you've got the Department of Humanities located in the Humanities College, which is has other departments offering general education courses. Same for natural science majors. So now what you have is an organizational structure where these people are all, these faculty members in these several different departments in each of these three areas, are all organized now to talk with each other about what their college is going to do.
Mm-hmm. When you recommended it, did you just recommend it to the president and he acted, or how did you?
I recommended it to the president. The president and I recommended the Board of Trustees, and the decision was made on a vote of 5-3. 5 in favor of discontinuing University College, 3 in favor of keeping University College.
And how did the people in University College, when they knew you were taking it to Board of Trustees, act?
They were vociferous in their opposition.
Did they present their side at the
yeah.
board meeting?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you, in essence, had not really spoken to them about what you were going to do?
Oh, no. Before I recommended the president, I met with the full faculty of University College and gave them about an hour's presentation
on what
I planned to do and why I planned to do it.
You got out of the room alive. Probably because half of them were so stunned they didn't know how to react. And I guess then they just moved off into the separate ones, and you're basically where you're at now, where you're...
Well, now there's been a subsequent development.
I understand. I just got one of the brief articles in the paper about how that they're in the process of doing some things to it now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Do you know where I can get a copy of this?
You can have that.
Oh, you don't mind? I appreciate that.
Now, this committee, known as CRUM, made major recommendations on undergraduate education at Michigan City, mm-hmm. including recommendations related to the issue of what has been called general education. More recently than that, the current provost, has recommended that in each of the three colleges, arts and letters, natural science, social science, that the departments, except for the Department of American Thought and Language, which again remains as it is, mm-hmm. the Department of Humanities, the Department of Natural Science, the Department of Social Science, be discontinued, and that in each of the three colleges there be established something called a Center of Integrated Studies.
Yeah, I
so we, in a certain way,
kind of
with a different administrative organization, we've come in a sense full circle.
Let me ask you this. If you were in a position that you could have and do anything you wanted to do, and one of the things, options that you'd been offered was the option of taking the old original university college going back, you know, 1950s, early 60s, and reinstituting that model again, having learned mistakes that they made in their, you know, forgetting their mission, would you do it? Would you bring that back?
The answer is a qualified yes. And actually, what I'm about to say may have been part of the original model, I'm just not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I would want for the entering freshman to have the opportunity to opt out of the integrative studies program by examination.
It was. It was part of
the original. I believe that was part of the original design.
Yeah, and I like that.
I think that's very important. Because just as we have some students who need that, you know, we have students who come in here with advanced standing.
They don't.
They'd be wasting their time.
One of the options, the way that option was organized, as I understand it, and I'll have to double check, so don't hold me to this. You basically had three options. You could take the course, you take it for examination and be exempt. You could also take it for credit.
Yeah, right.
And I thought that was a fascinating thing. I like the idea of the options like that.
That was, if you take that whole model, including those examination options,
mm-hmm.
I would like to see that available.
One of the things I've been bouncing off of people, because it was as I began learning about the problems mm-hmm. that had occurred between the specialist departments and the general faculty, and how they were literally in two different faculties within the mm-hmm. university, I was looking for how could you possibly get around that? And I've heard both pros and cons to joint appointments. And so what I have kind of thrown out as an idea, and I've been asking each person, you know, what do you think of this? The idea I was thinking of is you go to the specialist department and you say to the dean, okay, each year I'd like you to pick maybe one person from your department who you'll recommend, and that person will get a monetary and some other kind of reward for doing this. That they will go over into the general department, serve there for 2 years, and then come back. I think it would help to continue that. One of the things that I come to the realization that they didn't do, and it was something that Dr. Hanna kept saying over and over again in his memoirs, you've got to communicate. And I think they didn't.
That's right.
Who was it? I'm trying to think. Oh, Dr. Warrington made the point. He said, you know, we in his particular department, him and Dr. Dressel and them, who were so involved in the statistical analysis, the testing, he said, we spewed out at the end of every 10 weeks volumes of information. And he says, one of the biggest mistakes we made is we didn't stop once in a while, analyze it, and publish it.
Yeah.
And people had no idea what we were doing. He said, we had so much data there that if we had just shown people it was there, they would have salivated at the chance of just getting their hands on it and running with it themselves.
Although, actually, there were some...
I've seen some studies, and I'm trying to get as much as I can, because it will help support one way or the other.
There was one that I used, as a matter of fact, and I recommended the University College
And that was a study of student evaluation of the general educational offerings.
Mm-hmm. Now, what year was that? So I know to look for it.
Oh, I can't tell you that. It was probably either the late 60s or the early 70s. And the reason I placed it there is that I think to some extent University College used that as a justification for their tracks.
Oh, they interpreted it one
way. A good deal of expressed dissatisfaction. The question is, what was the dissatisfaction about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a kind of formal relationship between other parts of the university mm-hmm. and university college departments.
If you went back to the idealized model, is that what I'm saying?
And part of the original model, we've talked about part of it, but part of the original model, as I understand it, was that there were to be joint appointments.
Mm-hmm. The problem that, as in reading some of the things from Dr. Dressel and Dr. Blackman and Dr. Hamilton, the joint appointment, just in the area of committee assignments alone, was stretching some of these professors just too thin. And that's one of the reasons they backed off of it. They were literally asking too much of their professors. This is why I was thinking, rather than trying to go that route, maybe have them come in, spend time totally immersed, and then leave.
I think you're buying a red herring.
Okay.
Let me tell you, there was substantial silent support in terms of public statements, but mm-hmm. a considerable amount of silent support among members of the University College faculty in support of my recommendation. Mm-hmm. Really two issues. One, the career line of the University College faculty member as an individual was highly stereotyped.
I get that feeling.
Two, there was virtually no opportunity for discipline-oriented research activity.
So there wasn't a lot of research that was done in the...
Well, people did research, but it was unusual, and it often had to do with general education issues rather than disciplinary issues.
Mm-hmm. But was it at the same level as you got in the other department? Yeah, and I'm talking quantity versus quality.
Some of it. Not very many, but some.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know,
depending
a
on
man
the
named you Anderson, I don't remember his first name, who published many, many books.
Yeah, I interviewed Dr. Anderson in English.
There's a guy named Art Benner, who was in the Department of Social Science, who had an excellent publication. A guy named Krupke, in Natural Science, who had an excellent publication. Anybody mention this report to you?
I saw it in some of the literature, and I was going to try to dig it up, but no one has mentioned it
this
yet.
This is an extremely important document with regard to Michigan State University.
Future of the university.
This is 1959. This was John Hanna's way of sanctifying his decision that Michigan State University was going to try to become an AAU university.
Oh, okay.
We were admitted to the AAU in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
This was the springboard.
Now, I saw it mentioned in his in the archives under his title, but I haven't gotten
here. Here are some names. Richard Byram, who was dean of the College of Natural Science for many, many years. Paul Dressel. Doug Dunham, who was social science mm-hmm. at the University College.
Because you guys are Cherry Lane alumni,
et cetera. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
This committee recommended essentially that Michigan State transform itself from being a college to being a major research university. Now, I think that this was part of the background of the demise of University College.
Mm-hmm.
Because what this report did was to suggest that the typical faculty member at Michigan State University would be an important contributor to the advancement of knowledge. Which suggested if he or she would have been if, at the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. or University of Kansas, or Berkeley,
mm-hmm. or wherever.
Wherever. This really set new norms.
So you're saying that it might even go back further to 59, that the first seeds of...
Well, now go back to what I said about silent support.
Mm-hmm.
You had people who came to Michigan State University and University College who thought they were coming to this kind of a university and found themselves trapped in a career line that was did not include the opportunity to teach disciplinary majors, graduate students, or to conduct a meaningful disciplinary research program.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Very good point.
You change the nature of the institution. See, the basic college, if you go back then, remember, when the basic college was established here, this had been the agricultural college.
Mm-hmm.
It drew students from a large rural population in a small town. There was no television. These kids had gone to country high schools or small town high mm-hmm. schools. Basic college had a very, very different clientele than we had by the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, the institution had changed. It was no longer a college. It was now... It
sounds like, in a sense, some people wanted it both ways.
Yeah.
They wanted to keep as much of the land-grant philosophy as they could, but they also wanted to fit in.
But you see, the land-grant philosophy, in my judgment, has been characterized relatively inaptly. What people forget is that these agricultural colleges were established in order to provide the scientific basis for agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
The impetus was that agriculture had stagnated and the population of the country was growing and agriculture wasn't mm-hmm. carrying the usual share. It wasn't providing the expanding platform of food and fiber production that would permit the country to grow economically and become both more manufacturing and more urban.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the answer? The answer is to invoke science to support agriculture. And that's what the land-grant colleges are really about. Now that's no different than any other major research university. It's just more specialized.
Mm-hmm.
So, what happened was that whereas in agriculture, the faculty had been recruited and sponsored to be research scientists, through the Agricultural Experiment Station. Much of the rest of this institution was still a college, a four-year college with faculty who were teaching faculty. Then, in 1959, John Hanna, bless his heart, had decided that we were going to become an AAU institution, that is, we were going to take the College of Agriculture model within the institution, we were going to become that kind of institution in totality, that is a research university. Mm-hmm. And this is the way you get it. And again, part of the reason that I could recommend that we disband University College was that I was able to say, we're going to liberate 200 tenure system faculty positions to strengthen this as a major land-grant AAU institution.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I can see how the board would go with that.
Sure. I'm not going to give you that.
Oh, no, no. I
treasure that.
I got the feeling. When I saw how well-worn it was, I knew you've gone through it a few times. I have things like that myself as an administrator that...
Now there is a reference in here. page 13. Faculty for general education.
Definitely focus on that.
Regular faculty in basic college departments should be provided the same opportunity for scholarly investigation and research as exists for all faculty members. Where appropriate, use of teaching fellows in instruction programs in basic college should be encouraged. Where appropriate, qualified basic college faculty should be eligible to direct dissertations of teaching fellows engaged in the program.
So, I'm just kind of playing this back to you. It sounds to me like basically there were two things. This is an oversimplification, but it sounds to me like there were two things one thing really that was the ultimate demise of the University College more than anything else, and that was the radical change that all of America went through in the late 60s, early 70s, with the change in students and how they thought and acted, the change in faculty and how they thought and acted. It just came together one of the people that I was talking with, and I can't remember who, really said in a very humorous, but he was being humorous, but at the same time, it was kind of tragic situation. He says, you know, we were supposed to be the general thing that drew the whole university together. And he says, during the late 60s and early 70s, we served that purpose very well. Everybody hated us. He says, the kids said we were too inflexible. The professors thought that we were too inflexible. We were too old-fashioned. And he says, everybody agreed. And he says, we did at least in one area, we were common across, we had a common base across the whole university. And it sounds to me like that more than anything else, I think this goes back. J.D. Hirsch in his book made that comment about several other universities, Columbia in particular, that the insanity, as I consider it, of the late 60s, early 70s, just...
Yeah. Oh, I have to tell you, I think
it caused its demise or anything else.
I think University College would have been discontinued without that kind.
Really?
Because, as I say, they really abdicated their mission.
Well, some of the old timers say it was this young group who abdicated the mission, and that and with the support of the kids, they used the kids to help abdicate their mission. And
that's true. They use student support to get diversification of courses and tracks. There's no question about that.
When they lost their sense of mission because of that time.
But they had already started that.
Mm. Okay, so it was really the loss of mission more than anything else that caused their demise.
That and the discontinuity between the mission
situation.
Well, you know, one way to symbolize that, again, simplistically, is the 5-3 vote by the Board of Trustees. It is a complicated issue. You know, there are lots of considerations, but I think the question you have raised several times today is the key question, and that is there an appropriate mission for an integrative studies program in modern higher education? And I told you, I think, yes, there is, if it's a sophisticated model that recognizes the diversity among entering freshmen.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that idea of giving that out. I think that's excellent.
But the other thing you've got to do is provide for career change or diversification of career, the faculty. So if you look,
that's what I was trying to do with that moving in and out thing. But maybe that would do.
And you have a viable idea there, because you know, as a chairperson of dean, I've watched faculty's careers as individuals, because you know, I was involved directly in personnel decisions. And it's not always true, but many, many faculty members really shift their emphasis several times during their career.
You grow and change.
You know, somebody will get caught up in an interest in teaching undergraduates. Then they'll go back to their dissertation research and pick that up as a line of research, and that'll increase their interest in graduate education. They'll
you're booing out undergraduate education.
Your point of this of the instructor who's got all his coursework and his comps taken care of, he's just working on his dissertation. I think it's a good idea that that person be an instructor, and I think it's a marvelous opportunity for that. What you were trying to do, of trying to help them grow.
You see, what my idea was that there would be a kind of capstone seminar for advanced graduate students who were interested in undergraduate education as a part of their professional career. So these students would get some exposure to the principles of anthropology, political science, sociology, psychology, geography, economics, so that the psychology student would be more literate.
You know, the thing that I really liked about the University College here, as a taking it from a personal point of view, and I saw some of the things in the earlier things when they talked about the no preference person. I came in and I had a preference when I came here. I came in, I had done 2 years of undergraduate work in a pre-engineering program at John Carroll University in Cleveland, which is a Jesuit university, a very fine university. And I was in engineering, but I was in engineering because my father had decided his oldest would be an engineer, his second would be a doctor. I mean, it was his dream. And as long as I was home going to school, I was enamored of that dream. But when I got up here, I realized it wasn't for me. And having that university college to fall back on, and the exposure it gave me to many different options helped me, that when I made my decision, it's a decision I've stuck with for the rest of my life and feel very comfortable with.
And again, one of the things that I recommended and defended very strongly was that we have something called the Undergraduate University Division, which is an academic advising unit for freshmen and sophomores. We do not admit students still into colleges. All of our freshmen and sophomores are no prep students. They can have a major preference, but they're no prep students. And their academic advising, at least in part, is in the university, undergraduate university division. And so they continue to have the opportunity and even the encouragement to look around, open their eyes, look aside, and see what things there are that they might really be fascinated by. And that incidentally was part of the problem of University College. There were inclinations to direct students out of University College into certain majors. If it looked as though engineering was going to be a good area for getting jobs, there was a strong tendency to recommend to a lot of students that they become engineering majors, rather than being an academic advising unit that was committed to the idea of liberalizing through education.
Well, when I was in there, I forgot who it was, someone, and I think it was a fellow student, said go down to the counseling center, as he called it, and to this day I don't know where, but it was in the building for psychology, and they had some vocational interest tests, and I took the whole battery and then sat down with one of the people who analyzed my results and said, "Here's these are the inclinations it shows, these are the kinds of things you might want to pursue." And I really was impressed with the way, because he didn't say you should be this or you should be that, it just said this shows some high. In fact, he was fascinated because I had like about five that were just way at the top, and I'm the classic example of the guy who just destroys this idea of left brain, right brain.
Yeah.
I had a guidance counselor who worked for me who was convinced of that, and she used to come in and after she'd see me do something and would come in and she'd be so upset with me, she'd say, "Just when I thought I had you pegged, you'd do something over on the other side.
Right.
What is your problem?" And I said, "Quite frankly, I don't know, but I happen to love math and I love the arts."
Yeah.
What can I say? To me, I see the relationship between them. To me, math is a beautiful art form.
Sure.
And she couldn't grasp it.
Well,
used to drive her crazy.
Really sophisticated scientific theorists know that what they're dealing with are aesthetic judgments often.
Yeah.
The Big Bang Theory is as much an aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how some people can't grasp it.
As it is a rational invention.
Yeah.
Well,
Well, I appreciate everything, sir. I really have enjoyed sitting down and speaking with you. I hope that if I run into any questions online, I can give you a call.
Sure. Is there anything else you wanted to ask about?
At this point, I'm spinning because a lot of ideas that I have that you gave me.
Urge one thing.
Sure.
Really do look into the current planning on these centers for integrative studies.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications of that in terms of the curriculum designs that people are struggling with.
Okay. No, I'm going to read
because,
the report real carefully.
There's been a lot of good intellectual effort, I think, that has gone into trying to devise a curriculum which is world-oriented and future-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is something that was different from the context of basic college and even university college.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm struggling in my own mind philosophically because of what I'm seeing at the secondary level in how the level of preparation is not what I would like it to be. And quite frankly, I'm getting a little tired of these national people blaming educators.
Yeah.
I wish they would just realize that the problem is that the days of the early, mid-50s and early 60s of boards made up of doctors and lawyers have been replaced with housewives who are mad at a teacher for giving their daughter an F, and men who work down the street and are mad because their son didn't get to play in the big football game, and they come on with this attitude of, I'm going to get somebody. They have no idea what education is about. All they care about is keep my taxes down and keep my kid in the number one programs.
Right.
And they're living their fantasies through their children.
Yep.
And it's ruining our educational system, and it scares me for our country, because what it's coming down to is, if the universities don't save us, we're not gonna be saved. They're doing the high school job. I don't like it, but I've seen through personal experience that until somebody changes the nature of school boards, there's nothing an educator can do at the secondary level.
Well, on that point, I think what we're going to get is something that may not be much better, frankly, but at least it'll be different. I think we're really going to see in this country a move toward the European system, where you have state and national standards and bureaucracies.
Well, see, we're getting a lot of standards in Ohio right now. In fact, one of my biggest problems was that the state, and here's the irony, I supported what the state was doing. It made sense. But they brought in a tremendous number of changes in education called Senate Bill 140. And I've got a particular area where I'm at is Appalachia, and these people have no respect for authority. They are suspicious of outsiders, and they quite frankly ordered me to violate state standards.
No.
And I said, if you do it in public, I will. And that's where the loggerhead came. And that's why when I got this position, I was delighted. They don't understand why I'm so relaxed right now, but they haven't gotten the big room yet. Because I'm just going to walk on and say, sorry, folks, integrity with me comes before your personal self-interest. What can I tell you? It's scary, because what it comes down to is you can put all the standards you want. But that little school system out there in the middle of those hills in Appalachia, if they have five board members who don't
know
a damn about education.
I understand that, but what I'm saying is, what I think is going to happen is that we're going to change that.
Well, I hope so. What I'd like to see happen is that these boards be appointed.
And I think
board.
It's going to go further than that, frankly.
That scares me. And
that
probably
scares
you, too.
It scares the hell out of me, but I think what we're going to have are administrators who may still be called superintendents who are going to be appointed by a state bureaucracy.
And if they don't know curriculum, God help us.
Yep.
God help us if they don't know curriculum.
Or when they get out there, freewheeling in our community with the sanction of Big Daddy up in the state capitol.
See, the thing, one of the worst things I think ever happened in education, and this is something I hope never gets on any tape, is I think the biggest mistake we made was coming up with doctorate degrees in educational administration.
Absolutely.
I won't take my doctorate in education administration. I've taken every course that is required for it before I even went into my PhD, and I chose to take my PhD in curriculum because I looked at what they were doing and said,
bless you.
No big deal.
Yeah.
There's nothing here that's special.
And I've seen a lot of them like that. I'll never forget sitting down in front of a superintendent and presenting a curriculum model. And when I got done, he says, well, we'll put that on hold. And I went into his office afterwards. I didn't want to argue with him because I was his assistant superintendent. And I said, what's the problem? He says, well, it just doesn't grab me.
Yeah.
Grab you? I'll grab you.
If you, I don't know who you're in touch with. Are you in touch with the provost's office?
I talked with his with Arthur Scott's office briefly, but I could talk to him again about getting copies. I was thinking I'd just do it through Dr. Hunhart when I'm down the next time. In the archives, they probably have a copy of that in the archives.
They may have. If you can't find a copy, I'll chase one down for you.
I appreciate that. Well, thank you for everything, sir. I'm going to wrap this thing up here.